RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Welcome to our bird flu hysteria panel. That's kind of what I'm calling it. And we've brought some incredible people together this morning here at RCR to talk about, I'm sure you've heard it mentioned in the news, cases in Australia now, all those things. And we've kind of talked about it a bit, mentioned it in the last few weeks. So here to talk about this on our panel this morning is Matt Shelton. Hi, Matt. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, g'day, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Alison Goodwin. Alison, welcome back. Good to see you.
Hi, Paul. Yes, likewise.
Okay. In the dream team, Guy Hatchard. Hi, Guy.
Hi, Paul. Wonderful to be here.
And making it an absolute dream, Alia Bland. Alia, welcome to this panel this morning. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
Okay, I can't think of really a way to start this other than saying, oh dear, bird flu. Who wants to pick up and start talking right now?
It's a non-event. It's completely a non-event. There are no known cases of person-to-person transmission. There have been 800 or 900 cases over 27 years in 23 countries. That's an average of less than one person per year per country. This has been around for years and years and years. Why the sudden hysteria? Yes, it's been found in some cattle. And, why are we even sitting here? Why is the government even thinking about this?
We're sitting here, Guy, in case we get moves pulled on us and we want to be aware of it. Matt, what were you going to say?
Well, the inevitable comment, of course, is cry wolf. There are so many similarities in the timeline, the accelerated timeline, and the kind of exponential kind of fear and loathing messages. And we just have this WHO meeting, the World Health Association meeting, getting going, which is aiming to remove any discussion or dissent about how we manage our own our own version of a response to this. But a number of things come to mind. As Guy says, it's actually very hard to catch for humans. Was the subject of some very obvious gain-of-function research around 2012, 2013. And in fact, that stimulated the Obama administration to withdraw federal funding for research into tweaking viruses to make them more infectious and easier to catch. Now, that didn't mean that private industry couldn't contribute, and it wasn't banning the research altogether. It was just saying that federal funding was no longer to be available. But it didn't stop people doing contracting the work to be done overseas, and it didn't stop researchers working in each other's countries. That's the context that we have to use. It really does seem like we've been here before. There is no one currently, even in mainstream media, disputing the fact that the apparent coronavirus thing that we've all been dealing with was a bioweapon. It did come from a virology lab in Wuhan. No one is still trying to pretend that it didn't. And in fact, Congress in the States is hearing detail around the machinations that went on. So I see a lot of similarities. And I think the numbers that are being bandied around for the mortality are an exaggeration to say the least. And I would like to listen to, and I have been listening to, people who were, right on the nail from the beginning about COVID and the vaccines that were rolled out. And they were, right on almost everything. And they've been taking a look, and I'm talking about people like Peter McCullough. And they're not impressed either. And they're ringing the same alarm bells that I think are occurring in all our heads.
Yeah, I'm just reading a quote here from Dr. Peter McCullough, who we are familiar with, been on this program a few times. I fully expect the WHO in the next few days or weeks to declare avian influenza bird flu as a public health emergency of international concern. So he expects it. Alison, you expecting it?
Well, it wouldn't surprise me if they try and ramp this up, but, as Guy and Matt have said, what is it exactly? What are they, what are they testing for? That's what I want to know. What tests are they using and what exactly are they finding? I listened to that Canadian teleconference that was leaked, and you know, they're testing all sorts of milk, they're testing animals, they're running around figuring out exactly who and what to test. And obviously the more you test, you're going to find things, but what is the significance of those things? Are they, you know, are they sick animals? Are they, you know, what sort of animals, what sort of sickness? Do they get better? I mean, you know, we carry on about these diseases as if they're the end of the world, but, you know, we've got an amazing human immune system, and that is going to do its job in the vast majority of people, I would think.
And Alia, here we go again, do you think?
Well, yeah, I totally think. And it's interesting, I spent a bit of time with Dr. David Bell, the ex, you know, former WHO fellow who was in the country recently, and he was saying the same thing as McCullough was. He was saying that everything from his perspective was gearing up to this being the next thing that they use to impose their measures that they trying to ram through with the WHO World Health Assembly this week. But I mean, there's issues there, which has been good to see over the weekend. Suggestions that they haven't been able to form come to an agreement on it, and so that it might not be happening in the way that we thought it was going to at this point in time. But I've also spent some time reading through the Public Health Communications Centre Aotearoa, which is PHCCA, which is the entity that was formed, I think, in around February last year with Michael Baker and friends, and reading through some of their media releases and material that's on their website with respect to all of this bird flu hysteria. And you know, well, there's a few issues that I have with it is they are circular sort of reporting, referencing their own studies, which is an interesting thing to be doing. And I noticed that throughout all of the reports that I read was that they were citing science as if it was external, but it's really just from all of their team, which is, you know, it's a bit curious. But also that they are quite keen to cement in the response measures of the past 4 years, which is includes things like border management, case isolation, contact tracing and quarantine, ventilation upgrades, and masking and physical distancing. So they really, really want to see the COVID measures introduced again in this way to save us all from bird flu.
And does that mean VFF is about to spring into, well, not that you haven't stopped springing into action, but spring into action again?
I'm sure that there will be, you know, we're ready with this. We've got a lot of experience under our belts now, so we know what to look for. But, you know, it just shows you how eager they are to get back in that sort of hot seat of being the experts and giving all of the advice, no matter whether or not it's actually got any evidence to back it up. Quite the opposite, I would say.
You're absolutely on the money, Alia. I, you know, fame, power, influence are all very, very addictive, and they want to, and they are citing their own research. And I'm using inverted commas here when I use the word research. I the Cochrane Institute's latest update on masking basically said doesn't work. It's unreliable. It's not a great help. And then there's another paper published just this month entitled Wearing Face Masks as a Potential Source for Inhalation and Oral Uptake of Inanimate Toxins. And it gives a long list of toxins that you know can damage you, that are known to be damaging for the human respiratory system, which you have to take in if you're wearing a mask. They're just not referencing anything other than their own ideas.
That's just laundering news and information, really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
When it comes from your own sources. Yeah. Okay. In terms of timing, IHR, vaccine passports, all about this time. Is there some kind of coincidence of timing?
Well, it is interesting that it's all sort of ramping up just as the World Health Organization has their World Health Assembly meeting starting on the 27th. You'd have to wonder about the timing, isn't it? They want to pass all these legislation, all these rules to allow them to control the world, basically dictate the governments what each country should do. And yet all this, you know, this it's a worldwide phenomenon, this bird flu. It's happening all over the world at the same time.
One thing that's very interesting is that they've sort of started to go back to referencing the 1918 flu epidemic, and that they're not talking so much about COVID because it has been such a disaster, the response. But I was thinking about that. You see, the 1917-18 flu epidemic came on top of one of the most stressful and fearful times in the world. People were malnourished, exhausted, fearful. Their immune system was way down. They had very, very high stress levels, and a lot of people got sick and badly sick. And that shouldn't be any surprise. What's missing here in all this kind of miasma of talk of fear and so on is the fact that there are fundamentals of health. There are hygiene, there's good nutrition, there's making sure that people are happy and that they have the resources to live a decent life and so on. And they take exercise, and these things are absolutely account for 98% of our health. Why aren't we talking about these?
Matt, as I understand it, the epidemic that we talk about in the early 1900s, that wasn't necessarily, and here's dumb guy on the street here, but as I understand it, wasn't necessarily, you know, the pathogen, the actual virus that could end up killing you. It's the secondary bacterial infections that there was no defense for. Penicillin wasn't there. And if that's the case, then it's totally spurious using that as some sort of an example, isn't it?
Well, it is. But as Guy's pointed out, you know, the most recent example is not a great example. And in fact, the illustrious Dr. Anthony Fauci himself, early on in his career, wrote a paper. But I think it might have been a master's thesis, actually, looking at the Spanish flu. And he concluded that most of the deaths were actually from secondary bacterial pneumonia, not from, you know, whatever the influenza was in the first place. And that, you know, the widespread use of masks, but without really understanding, you know, how they could become a petri dish for all sorts of bugs that would normally live in your mouth and your upper airways anyway, was absolutely lethal. But, you know, there were other very interesting features about that epidemic or pandemic that still really nobody's explained satisfactorily, and that would be a very interesting topic in itself. But I don't think we should get too far away from where we are now. And that's a reminder that this version of avian influenza, the H5N1, and there are various subtypes of that floating around too, but has always been very difficult for humans to catch, as Guy said. Now, of course, this dual-use research that's been going on, where they sort of acknowledge tacitly that you know, the research may well be funded by the military, who are perhaps, you know, looking for being able to rapidly roll out a vaccine to protect their own troops or protect citizens in the event of biological attack, etc. You know, does have this implicit dark side, which is that, you know, you may want to use the thing as a weapon yourself. You know, and this is the context that we have to remember, that there are hugely powerful industries at play here, not just the obvious players like the vaccine industry, that potentially or actually will be making out like bandits from what happens next. You know, and this is the biggest money on the planet at play, you know, in many different ways. And you know, following the money usually provides an explanation for what's going on behind the scenes. And I think we've learned, or we should have learned, a very healthy distrust of almost everything that is said by our public health authorities about this, because they have miserably and spectacularly failed, you know, to spot the traps and actually protect the people from everything that they just bought into without raising an eyebrow or doing their own critical thinking and their own independent research, because of this idea that illustrious organizations like the WHO must be impossibly cleverer than the rest of people. That you know, and we're in a small country, and maybe we can't even begin to find experts, you know, who should do their own independent thinking on all this. So we just default immediately to authority. And I want to just move us, if I can, a little way from this, because last week we saw a great example of the absolute lack of any separation between the state and the judiciary. We took a case that hinges around essentially the Bill of Rights and how important it is to protect us from really bad government policy decisions. And essentially it was left in tatters on the floor. And many of our complaints about the COVID rollout were, again, around the suspension of all the norms that would normally protect people. You know, the Bill of Rights is our first and last line of defense. You know, it's a protection against, you know, tyrannical behaviors by government. But it also should be a protection against mistakes, entrenched error, and really bad misreading of scientific advice that is rolled out. And we, you know, we worry that certainly the lower courts, you know, don't seem to understand that anymore. And this may well be relevant in our ability to push back against anything that's going to be happening, you know, going ahead with the bird flu.
Over the weekend, I saw, you know, a new wave of mutated COVID. I think it's called Flirt or Furt or something that's coming through. Interesting the way they name these, and already the usual suspects, and I'm thinking of one in particular, is talking about an extensive review of masks worldwide, et cetera. It amazes me, and who wants to comment, that some people just double down no matter what. How to explain that? Because the information is out there, man. I mean, any person and their dog knows that masks are highly questionable, if not completely irrelevant. Yet here they are banging on. Go, Alia.
Yeah. I was reading that Public Health Communication Centre's article on that. In particular, one of the studies that they were talking about, and I've highlighted here on my piece of paper, one thing that really stood out to me that they included as one of their points, which was that socio-cultural significance of masks. And they've said masks serve as an important socio-cultural symbol, with non-adherence often linked to political, wow, ideological, okay, beliefs and misinformation. So they are... Yeah, they're really trying to.
That's the quiet bit out loud, usually, isn't it?
If you don't.
Well, yes, the masks are, yeah, an easily visible symbol of who is compliant and who is not. And I just want to comment about that word comply, because that word featured multiple times in the court case Matt referenced last week. Comply. That's what we have to do. Comply, comply, comply.
That was our fluoride challenge, by the way. I don't think I mentioned that.
Yeah,
no, you didn't.
We were challenging the ability of Hastings District Council, actually, to go ahead and start water fluoridation while there is an order on the Director General of Health. In fact, two successive Director Generals of Health have failed to do a Bill of Rights assessment on Bloomfield's order, actually, for 16 councils to start fluoridation. So we saw an opportunity to test the reliability of the Bill of Rights at its most basic. But just coming back to the mask thing, Michael Baker is a co-author of out of 13, I think, on a review that they're quoting that's supposed to be the final word on proving that masks work. And I just had a catch up with a mate of mine today who was at a concert on Friday night, I think, where he bumped into Michael Baker, and he couldn't contain himself. And he said to Professor Baker, "How dare you come out without a mask and put everybody at risk? We're all terrified of what we might catch from you." He wanted to say a lot more, and his wife managed, I think, to keep him on the right side of getting into big trouble. But I thought that was interesting timing.
Yeah, lucky I wasn't there. I can tell you that. Here's, I guess, a question that is an obvious one, maybe for this part of the chat. We've had a change of government. There are different political characters in there now, and maybe one would think at first thought that, you know, there is, I don't know, we have a more firm political stance possibly against these things with the New Zealand First Party in there and what they've been doing, but also, of course, the National Party. There's Shane Retty, the health minister. There's ACT in there as well. How strong do you think the political forces are now, either way, facing another round of this sort of thing. Guy, maybe you want to answer that.
They're completely out of touch because they have no data. I mean, I'm someone who's recently spent a lot of time in the medical system for reasons I really would. I found the whole thing in chaos, absolute chaos. I had senior nurses telling me that they didn't know really what's going on. I tried getting an appointment for my condition. I was supposed to have an appointment 6 weeks after a major operation. It's 6 months. And I still haven't been offered an appointment at this point. I still haven't managed to get an appointment. The whole system is overwhelmed. And this is the story that is being hidden. And they're hiding it behind this ridiculous waffling about bird flu that no one has and no one can, virtually no one can catch unless they sort of have a sick bird in bed with them for most of the
days. Chicken.
Yeah,
they're
fighting. They're out of touch. They're completely. They don't know what's going on. They're not collecting the data. Look at the data. You know, if you try and mine the data here, it doesn't exist. It in 2021, it disappears. We don't know what's happening with cancer or heart disease, and the very people working in the system do not know what's happening. All they know is that they don't have any time and they're overwhelmed. And the job of the nurses in critical departments, and again, I've experienced this, is to fend off people, is to keep them at their distance and say, why don't you go and see your GP? You know, you have people seriously ill that are being pushed away. They're defending the doctors now, a lot of nurses, you know, personal assistant nurses in specialist areas are actually defending their doctors so they won't have to face patients because there are so many patients.
Yeah.
And that is what is being hidden by this ridiculous waffling that we're getting from people like Michael Baker about wearing masks. I mean, people are coming down with cancers, with heart disease, with neurological conditions in numbers that we've never seen before. People are dying and no one wants to talk about it. Whoa, what's going on?
Anyone else have anything to say about that?
Well, I think all of us here have been talking about it relentlessly for 3 or 4 years. but, you know, Guy's right. We get contacted by a lot of people telling us their stories. Not many, you know, want the stories put out with their names attached to it. But, you know, we know truth when we hear it, and we know a consistent and relentless, you know, bunch of themes that we keep hearing. And we're hearing it from doctors inside the system, too. You know, and many patients say that actually their specialist couldn't wait to tell them that you know, they're seeing a lot of this, and their waiting rooms full of other people with myocarditis. And that, you know, cancers are exploding, but they won't speak out officially. And it seems like they're not even talking to each other about it, but they're needing to confess to somebody. So they're telling their patients. So we hear this theme, you know, loud and clear. And my own GP, who's sort of awake to what's going on, said to me some time ago, look, it's just as well that you know, you're out of medicine at the moment because Rome is burning.
Whoa.
And there is no way back. You know, he's describing his life, trying to advocate for a much sicker population than he's ever had. But I think just coming back, somebody mentioned, you know, the chickens, and I think a really sinister part of this is the focus, you know, surprise, surprise, on chicken and beef.
Yeah.
You know, two major sources of human protein. You know, we've already seen signs of you know, of a war on food and particularly farming, and nudges to sort of get us ready for fake meat and insects and a plant-based diet. And what a miraculous coincidence of timing.
Here we go again with the timing. Timing again.
Yeah, that's going to bugger up our KFC and our Big Macs.
And our export industry.
But there are much healthier things you can do with chicken and beef, of course. And I think this has got to deserve comment. And we've got to push back on this. And again, I think the politicians, you know, as they always did, have a responsibility to step up and give us good information and actually look out for us. But I'm not seeing huge signs that there's much different. You know, there's tantalizing possibility that there are things going on behind the scenes, but none of us know for sure. You know, and we need to see the color of their money and quickly, I think.
Someone once told me that if you want to conquer America, kill all the chickens.
Well, yes, there's also the raw milk, and that was a focus of this Canadian discussion, was raw milk. And I know our local raw milk producer has had to jump through excessive hoops, and they have jumped and they have jumped and they've done gone above and beyond, and they still get harassed. But there's also bees testing for whatever, with whatever sort of test, and the bees are destroyed. And without bees, plants don't get pollinated.
Yeah, so it's the American fowl brood that we've been talking about. Yeah. It's interesting how it's all
our plant-based diet, then.
Synchronized kind of to those foods. Alia, in terms of vigilance at a political level, which I was kind of trying to touch on before, how much faith do you have in the current crop of politicians to go, whoa, we're not doing this on bird flu or anything like that?
I'm heartened in the sense that they do appear to be listening to some things that are going on and attempts to communicate with them. So that's a good thing. Certainly improvement on the last lot. So that gives me a little bit of hope. And I think that what I've observed is that these people in these positions really are very reliant on the information that they are given by their advisors. And so it's sort of up to people in the positions like NZDSOS and us to, you know, give them some condensed, sort of easy to understand material that's well supported with evidence and that sort of thing, to help educate them on what the issues are as we see them. So I think, you know, that it's a positive thing that we're able to do that now, whereas we were absolutely not.
But isn't Luxon pretty keen on vaccination, particularly for young disadvantaged kids, let's say? Shane Retty, what's his stance on that? He seems like quite a orthodox normie doctor to me. Maybe one of the doctors can comment. That leaves you and I out, Alia, by the way.
Shane's a GP and he understands the power of the collective. And, you know, virtue signalling sometimes is the right thing to do, but sometimes you pick the wrong, you know, the wrong thing at the wrong time. And general practice is it's in a state of destruction, actually. It's been clear to me as a practicing GP for over a decade that primary care is not valued and not seen in the way that it used to be. And partly that's the fault of, you know, doctors who don't go off and learn about the causes of metabolic disease that is actually what's been overwhelming the health system for decades. You know, the consequences of obesity and diabetes. You know, that feeds into cancer and vascular diseases and strokes, heart disease, things like that. And the fix in those is actually basic nutritional environmental medicine principles that doctors aren't taught. So the gatekeeper function that general practice always had, which was to keep people out of hospital, you know, has plainly been failing, you know, from the time when the obesity epidemic really sort of kicked in and became noticeable. So I think there was a political decision taken some time ago, you know, to wit, the Ministry of Health, you know, barely has any doctor representation in it. It's calling in pharmacists and sort of nurse advisors and things. And I just don't think there's been political patronage to support primary care. And I think Shane's going to find that probably. And Alia's point about getting good information. We've seen evidence already that you know, bureaucrats and advisors in Parliament are not actually being truthful with ministers on some issues. I'm not going to be any more specific than that, but I can, you know, say that with confidence. And that's not a surprise, frankly, because this thing has become far too big to fail. And I know, you know, Guy has written extensively, and we have too, and we all talk about what it's going to take for people to put their hands up and say, right, I'm out of here. You know, I've got to start saying what's going on, rather than being part of a huge, majority, and I'm not going to say moral majority, but a huge majority that all have the same amount to lose. And I think, however, you know, honest one's intentions are, I think once you become a minister and part of the machinery, it seems things change very, very quickly in terms of what you can do, what you're allowed to say. And this, of course, is the problem with party politics and with the style of government we have. In the end, it's all about consensus and doing whatever you have to do to maintain some sort of faith in, you know, the hymn book that everybody sings from. And I think that that's probably impossibly hard to do anything about from the inside.
There's been a thank you, Matt. There's been an interesting change that's going on. The way that social media is regulated has sort of loosened up on COVID. You can say a lot of things about COVID and the pandemic without getting biffed off social media. But I can tell you now that the thing that is really attracting the censors is anything that criticizes biotechnology. They want that off the agenda because that's where the big money is. The really big money is our biotech future. And everyone's invested in this. The people who own social media, people in government. It really is this huge illusory industry that is not really producing anything useful, but it's making a lot of people a lot of money through shares and investments and so on and so forth. And this is a great South Sea bubble because the evidence is accumulating that it's really, really dangerous. More problems emerging with these, you know, more papers coming out all the time that more invasive the technology that you're using, the more dangerous it is in the physiology. So there's a, I mean, my, I just wrote the other day because I was having my hair cut and then the hairdresser said to me, you know, I said I hadn't been well. And she said, oh, yes, it's all comes down to genes, doesn't it? And the corollary of that is that if you could edit my genes, I'd be okay. This is the big illusion. And it's funny because I'm pushing that, as you know, pushing the fact that we have to ban this gain of function research and this experimentation on humans and so on. And the pushback from social media and the, you know, cutting you out of an audience and so on is going full speed. It's shifted. And this really is the government here is sort of encased in databases of information which are trying to push policies in and decisions in particular directions. So we think we're local, but we're already global because our databases at MedSafe and other areas of government and through Five Eyes and so on, they're totally tied into a global perspective that is rushing to the cliff.
Who benefits from bird flu? Is it vaccines for livestock, animals, or ultimately humans? Where's the first round of money making?
It's got to be vaccines. And we tend to look at the specifics, you know, but there's a whole generalized program of switching medicine into these high-tech areas where, you know, and it's an absurdity because you may have a team of 1,000 doctors working to cure one person using this high-tech medicine. It's never going to work. It's never going to be a mass door to health for the population. It's going to be a mass door for a lot of people to get rich by making up a lot of stories that are designed to deceive people as to what is going on.
I saw some footage of the authorities in Australia dealing with the case that had been found, and it was the same old thing. It was the emergency hazmat vehicle with all the aerials sticking up, people walking around in hazmat suits, you know, the whole theater of it. So I kind of thought, well, that's probably what we're going to expect to see. Part of the theater also is testing, endless testing of sewage, testing of using PCR tests, all of that. And ultimately, back to your point, Matt, livestock. This is, could end up in mass cullings, couldn't it? I mean, I'm just trying to see the picture sort of roll out the way we could expect, based on what we've already seen, that we could expect to see.
Well, I think you're right to expect it. I mean, the signals have been loud and clear that, you know, we have to stop eating meat. We have to get rid of farming.
But if you take out a whole lot of cows or cattle in the national, whatever they call it, it's not the flock, is it, the herd, then that's going to start feeling and looking brutal and could affect the bottom line.
Well, that whole industry is already under extreme stress. You know, the prices they're getting, you know, versus, of course, what we're paying in the supermarkets, which has never been higher. You know, they're already on the back foot, and it's not going to take much more to essentially drive people out of livestock production. And there are precedents, of course, for culling an entire national herd that we've seen in the last couple of decades, you know, BSE and hand, foot and mouth. So I don't doubt that this will come if we don't resist. And, you know, maybe this is what will wake people up, you know, when it actually hits them in the stomach. But your point about, you know, there's money being made at every single level. You know, this whole profit machine is sort of vertically integrated, you know, from the testing. And again, remember about the COVID, these sort of fake tests for God knows what, you know, that had no real reliability. And if you amplify them enough, you know, you can test positive to anything that you want. So we had the sort of manufactured numbers and failing to distinguish between cases by testing and people who are actually sick. You know, nobody's ever seen the COVID virus. I wonder if anybody's ever actually seen or grown H5N1 by the same thing. You know, we have to just rely on what we're told. And I don't trust these people. And I don't think any of us should. You know, when it comes to essential basic life supporting things like food and our ability to, you know, to move freely, to speak freely, you know, to have our own finances, you know, all of these things, somebody else is going to plunder. And we've seen the weaponization not just medicine, but of finance itself, of technology, as you say, Guy. And I love the quote in your last or penultimate piece, I think, where you said the problem is that, you know, doctors just haven't got a clue about the ABC of the dangers of fooling around with genetics. You know, they're not only not taught this stuff, but what they are told is a load of rubbish. You know, it's the magic panacea. Well, how well has that worked out for all the people that have been harmed by the COVID vaccine, for instance?
And COVID itself. Yeah, as you started off in saying, it's now, you know, it's open secret that COVID definitely came from a bioweapon lab.
And was managed by the Department of Defense in the US, according to some of the guests we've had, which sounds like a war-footing response.
Yeah, we're in a mass hysteria. And the government are caught up in that. We tend to sort of look to the government, go cap in hand, will you do this, will you pass that, will you protect our rights, and so on and so forth. But they're being swept away in a tsunami of mass hysteria that there's no logic or rhyme or reason there. But I mean, when I look at it, it's funny, you know, last night I watched or began to watch a movie called The Day After, which was in 1983.
I remember that after the nuclear war, right?
Yeah, it was about a nuclear war. It was about a full-on nuclear war, and it was an absolutely frightening movie with a bleak, bleak outcome for everyone. And the movie carried a little warning for the viewers that this is not, none of this portrayed here is real and didn't actually happen. And then it said, but if a war were to happen, it would be far, far worse.
Gosh.
And I think that's the situation.
It was already pretty bad in the movie, yeah.
We are in a situation that is far, far worse than people are even beginning to imagine. There's this sort of hysteria and madness. There's an acceptance of sort of nuclear conflict as somehow being a resolution of something.
Yeah.
There's a belief that vaccines that don't actually work and don't actually prevent disease are somehow our future. These are mad, deeply mad ideas. And this is definitely a form of mass hysteria. We have to, I mean, it's good that we're having this discussion because we're stepping outside of it. But can our politicians step outside of that? It's a big question.
I want to ask this question before everyone comments on the next thing. Can we say that it seems like the COVID-19 vaccines that New Zealand has got that aren't vaccines but GMOs or whatever, have they degraded the immune systems of our people at scale? Can we confidently say that? Do we think that? Do we suspect it? Because that will lead on to my next question.
Absolutely. And Matt, you should have a say too. I mean, look at where we're at with our health. Our health is, for example, the call-outs of ambulances up from around 100 per 1,000 people to 130.
Well, yes, that's probably more for the cardiovascular events, but for the infection and the lowered immunity, I mean, I guess the schools are probably a pretty telling place. Teachers absent, students absent.
Schools closing, actually.
Kids being sent home because there aren't enough teachers to teach them, with COVID infections and such like. But the immune system's also involved in cancer. When the immune system stops surveilling your cells each day and getting rid of the dodgy ones, that's when cancer can happen. And so I think the immune system, has been impacted adversely, both with regards to infections, but also with regards to cancer.
I think we can say with absolute confidence now that so much is known about the exact explicit mechanisms by which the effects of the sort of change in, I don't want to call them vaccines, these genetic transfer devices, but the effects that they have on many aspects of immune functioning, so that all the things that were warned about, and we warned about in our first open letter, we talked about vaccine-associated enhanced disease, and the lack of testing for genotoxicity, for carcinogenicity, the liability to cause cancer. And subsequently, lots of research has been published, detailing, many mechanisms that are probably all converging in many people to lower immunity to all sorts of things. But one thing that we've been hearing also here is the loss of the seasonal variability in the amount of infectious disease. Very clearly, it was always, late winter was the busiest time. After Christmas, for the next few months, everybody heaved a sigh of relief. Patients were healthy, they were getting lots of sunshine. And there's always a sort of a peak around Christmas and New Year because of the combined effects of sort of alcohol and sugar, tends to cause things like, boils and pneumonias. So you see, and tonsillitis and stuff like that. But generally there's a seasonal variability and that's been lost. Doctors are saying they're just busy all the time. Hospitals are clogged all the time. And this is true in the northern and the southern hemisphere. And okay. I think that's a very important clue that there has been harm to the nation's immune system.
Okay.
And actually, how can there not be when we look at exactly how these things work and what the consequences are?
Okay, always conscious of being up against the clock. So, Alia, to you, because I was getting towards messaging, how do you sell this? If you want to have round two, it has to be a harder sell, doesn't it? Because people... Well, there are people like us, people who are questioning. I know there are still people who still believe in it. But to make it believable and to ramp up enough, I guess, fear to put people into action, linking the problems that are legacy from COVID and COVID vaccines, showing themselves through people being more susceptible to anything else, can drive a next level of fear, can't it? So if people are seeing people sick everywhere or doing badly, they're going to automatically assume that this is a worse thing, when it could be actually a legacy of the last thing, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a hard one to get across to your general public, because there's a level of, blinkering that's going on with respect to this stuff. But I would imagine that it's not going to be as easy as it was last time, because a lot of people have woken up to just the effects of the COVID response in general, with not even necessarily the vaccine, but lockdowns on businesses and lifestyles. And, you know, you just need to walk up the main street of Auckland and Queen Street and see the number of stores that are closed and businesses that are shuttered up. You know, our recent guests that had come from overseas were making those remarks that they couldn't believe the number of, you know, vacant buildings and signs that are up now. So I think that it will be more difficult for them to get this one over the line. However, you know, all they need is some clever video of somebody looking and suffering terribly.
Collapsing in Lambton Quay.
Yeah, exactly right. That will do work wonders for the whatever they're wanting to suggest. But hopefully it doesn't come to that. I mean, I think about what we need to do from this point, and it's what we've kind of been trying to do with VFF for the last 3 years, is a multi-pronged approach. So you've got, you're trying to appeal to government on one level with information and requests and all that sort of stuff. And then you're also trying to educate the public about the issues in really simplified sort of terms so that people can understand what's going on. You're not going to stand up against something if you don't get it, if you're not educated on it. So that's another thing that we have to do. But then there's a third, which is just building your own resilience. And that might be with your own personal body and your health, but your family's sort of financial resilience, and then broader than that, your community. So there's lots of things that we can do. I would hope to think that people don't feel hopeless in all of this, because I think that, you know, we're in quite a good position coming out of the last 4 years, in the sense that there's a lot more sceptical people out there.
To bring the hammer down harder, do we consider something else in the mix, something like measles? Anybody want to talk about measles?
There's been a comment in some mainstream media, I can't remember exactly which, about increased surveillance for infectious disease. And there was talk about testing wastewater on planes. Talk about not being able to exit or enter into the country without proof of measles immunity. So definitely measles, you know, if you look back through just one mainstream media, Radio New Zealand headlines about measles, is, I don't know, 20 plus articles about measles in this year already. I think, and Dr. Whetty's spoken about measles. So definitely measles.
How dangerous is measles? I've had it. We went to parties back in the day. I remember being dropped off.
Everyone over the age of about 55, I think everyone born before 1968 is assumed to have had measles as a child and recovered, if they're still here to tell the tale.
I am, hello.
But yes, it used to be a childhood illness. But yes, the vaccination has changed nature and the timing of measles, so it's perhaps not the same disease as it was. But yes, certainly... A healthy, well-nourished child that is able to be cared for by a competent parent should be able to breeze through measles, or should have been able to breeze through measles. And vitamins vitamin A in particular is important, but vitamin C also.
Yeah, but you get that and N1, N5, H1, whatever it is, and maybe throw in a few others for good measure, and you've got people running around like headless chickens, potentially. Easy to persuade and control. That's really what I'm getting to.
There was a, prior to COVID, they'd already identified that there was a group that was lacking immunity in their eyes with not having had the MMR vaccine. And so there was a big campaign that was scheduled to go on that year to target those that group of sort of mid to late teens through to, I think, 30-year-olds. And obviously with everything that happened with COVID, that had to be sort of set aside for a period of time. So it appears to me that they're picking that back up again. And no doubt they will use all sorts of fear-mongering to try and drive those numbers up higher, because of the vaccination rates have reduced over the last few years, whereas I guess, you know, people have some vaccine hesitancy after what they've witnessed go on. So that could be part of it. But I would also say to people, you know, you've got to always ask questions when you're being presented with information that would suggest that there's, greater hospitalization or more, you know, incidents of trouble with the infection itself. Ask, you know, dive into that and see what it is that they're relying on to make those statements. Because back in 2019, I decided, because they were saying the same sorts of things, oh, look, all the rates of hospitalizations have gone up. And so I thought, okay, what? How do they define hospitalization? And I discovered that they had changed the criteria that was that somebody with measles was being written down as a hospitalized case was if you were in the system for 3 hours, in the hospital system for 3 hours, meant that you were hospitalized, inverted commas. And so
I bought a coffee at the cafeteria.
Yeah, they could drive those sorts of numbers up by fiddling with the statistics of it, of how the criteria works.
But so, if the hospitals are full, and Guy and, well, you all were explaining, then it's easy to pin it on the new thing and no one kind of goes too deep. I'm just thinking.
You have to ask questions and you have to read the scientific literature, and that's absolutely what you have to do to get into this. You really have to, you know, be awake, and you have to look at the detail, all sorts of numbers being blown around about a number of diseases. Top physician in the UK claiming that everybody should be put on Ozempic, the weight loss drug, because, you know, there's a lot of obesity. So, well, everyone should take this highly.
Well, that will fix it, won't it? Yeah. Oh, dear.
These are mad ideas. I can't. And don't be complacent. If I was to leave a message with everyone on this topic, absolutely, we can't be complacent, because history shows that if you are complacent, the whole thing can drift into tyranny in a minute. I've lived in the Soviet Union, and I went through the turmoil when the Soviet Union was overthrown. It was a really interesting experience. And I've been to other countries too, and worked in other countries where, if you accept these things, they become part of this amount of control and this lack of rights. They absolutely get set in concrete very, very quickly. And we're in exactly that situation here, coming off the Ardern government, where our Bill of Rights was trashed.
Fluoride has shown that they don't even think of it, actually, when they make their decision.
No, power has its own logic. Once you get into a piece of a power, you start to assume more of it. We've all lived long enough to know how this happens. We've all seen it. And I think people, if they really reflect on it in the streets, can realize that we're at a time where people are trying to seize the reins of power over everybody and force them to do things that they've dreamed up.
Yeah. We've got 5 minutes left, so probably best just to go through. I think that sounded pretty definitive, Guy, unless you've got something else you want to come back with at the end. So let's go top down the way I can see. Matt, what do you want to say before this? We've finished chatting?
Look, I've had a real kind of learning just in the last week. I'm certainly getting involved with fluoride and actually understanding how far back the evidence of harm goes. You know, it was clear in the 1950s. That fluoride was a neurotoxin. So many governments have come and gone, many regulators have come and gone. But what is kind of consistent, and where I think we need to look, are these nameless mandarins, these bureaucrats, you know, these career people who nobody knows, you know, who sit there while governments come and go, and they just produce this policy with goodness knows what lobbying, what conflicts of interest, what understanding or not of actually the real science. And it just sort of percolates and permeates, and then it gets delivered as policy. You know, and we need a protection somehow from the really bad policy that keeps coming out. I've been concerned about the state of our representation and our regulators and things for some time. I'm now more worried too that the courts seem to be being weaponized against us. Mainstream media, we've all seen that. But I think, you know, I think we've got to redouble our efforts, actually, to force the courts to declare, you know, are they with the people? Or are they not? Mm. By taking every challenge that we possibly can, of course, it's got to be funded somehow, that shines a light on what is obviously happening behind the scenes.
Alia.
All right. I would just say to people to, yeah, like what we were saying before, keep asking questions, but also to share stuff, to share these kinds of conversations that you're hearing, the replays, the interviews with people on the topics that matter. And it does make a difference. If I'm looking at what's been happening with the WHO and the international health regulations, the pandemic agreements, all of that kind of stuff, the world is starting to stand up. And that only happens by, you know, one conversation at a time. But it's, you know, the more that happens, the more of a chain reaction happens, and we start to see public pressure having a really tangible result. And so I would just encourage people to keep on having those conversations wherever you go. Share these interviews, because that's what this station is all about. We are here to arm people with good information that is shareable and understandable for people who might only just be hearing it for the first time.
And Dr. Alison Goodwin, last call on this panel. Alison, what do you want to say before we wind up?
Right. Well, I just want to remind everyone that they do have an immune system, and there's quite a lot people can do to look after their immune system, even if it is compromised or has been compromised by the last few. I mean, I think everyone's immune system, in fact, will be compromised by the last 4 years because we've been under immense stress. So, you know, the foundations of that, you've got to think about your vitamin D, and everyone in winter, vitamin D will be going down. So just, you can get it checked if you're willing to pay for it. You can assume that it's getting low, and do something about it. Vitamin D, vitamin C, real food, good sleep, and, you know, try and have stress reduction episodes, stress reduction practices in your daily life.
Serenity now.
yep, and a bit of fun and getting together with other people. Yes, my kids keep telling me I need to have more fun. But, looking after your immune system, looking after your health, and not being scared, just taking a breath, asking questions, not relying on a single source of truth. Turn off the mainstream media. That would be my number one thing to get rid of the fear.
The first part of the treatment.
What was that?
The first part of the treatment.
Yes, turn off the mainstream media. Yep.
Yeah, all right. Okay, well, I think this has been very useful, this panel discussion on the, well, it's around bird flu because that's what's approaching, but really the strategies and mindsets and everything that we kind of need to maintain. I want to thank Alison Goodwin and Matt Shelton, NZDSOS. Thanks for coming in, you two. Also, Guy Hatchard, always great. And thank you, Alia, for coming in as well to talk about this issue. And here we go. Here we go again. This is how I feel. Get ready.
Hopefully not, but thanks, Paul.
Strap in. Buckle up. Okay. Have a great day. Thank you.
Thanks.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom by simply visiting www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.